Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Well, Donald Trump is about to watch something that he has spent much of his adult life trying to avoid, opening statements in his own criminal trial. And we have a pretty good sense of what his playbook is going to look like as the trial unfolds. The law firm of Weissman & Katyal is here to break it all down as only they can. Plus, an exclusive interview with California Governor Gavin Newsom. We'll debut a new ad the governor is putting on the air in Alabama. I'll also get his thoughts on the former president's trial and what it means for the 2024 race. Also today, foreign aid bills finally pass in the House, but not without plenty of drama fueled by Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Putin wing of the Republican Party. And later, a conversation with superstar singer and superstar activist John Legend. I'll ask him about the incredible work he's doing on criminal justice reform and get his take on the state of our politics. In the words of Judge Juan Marchand, this trial is starting. The full jury in Donald Trump's New York criminal trial has now been sworn in. There are 7 men, 5 women, and 6 alternates. And they will hear opening statements starting tomorrow. Now, it wasn't exactly a smooth road to get here, in large part because defendant Donald Trump was all but digging the potholes himself. With an assist, of course, and this is important, from some of his cable news allies.
She said 2 things that really stuck out. One, quote, I don't really have an opinion of Trump, and quote, no one is above the law. I'm not so sure about juror number 2.
Trump then quoted Waters in a post writing, they are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury. Now, that is not only a complete lie, but according to prosecutors, it's also a violation of Trump's gag order. And it is clearly an attempt to undermine and intimidate the people who simply showed up at the Manhattan courthouse to fulfill their civic duty. I mean, the very next morning, a seated juror, the same juror who was called into question by Jesse Waters, asked to be removed because she had concerns about being publicly identified. That hardly sounds like a coincidence to me. And even a number of those who were not directly targeted by a Fox News segment or a Truth Social post expressed extreme anxiety about this trial. One reportedly broke down crying during questioning, saying, I have to be honest. I feel so nervous and anxious right now. I'm sorry. Another said, I have really, really bad anxiety, and people have found out where I am. It's pretty easy to see why they might feel that way. I mean, imagine being called for jury duty and then facing a defendant like Trump who has a known history of going after anyone and everyone. Not to mention, he has an audience of MAGA faithful who take his words quite literally. That has long been his strategy, and it is likely to continue as his trial goes on. To that point, a former member of Trump's White House legal team told journalist Olivia Nuzzi, quote, he expects some jurors will begin to crack under the immense pressure they will be under. No doubt a lot of that pressure will come from Trump himself, because a fair trial decided by an impartial jury of his peers may be what he fears the most. But he also may be underestimating these 12 people who made it through multiple rounds of extensive questioning, who were carefully selected to do the job they've been asked to do. The founding fathers put jury trials in the Constitution because they give citizens the final say. They put the power in the hands of we the people, of the ruled, not rulers. Joining me now is our in-house law firm. Neil Katyal is the former acting U.S. Solicitor General, and Drew Weissman is the former general counsel at the FBI and a senior member of special counsel Robert Mueller's team. So, Neil, I just want to start there where I ended. I mean, obviously, as a citizen non-lawyer like myself, you hear that and you think, that sounds intimidating. These jurors are scared. From a legal standpoint, I mean, is this considered juror intimidation? And how concerned are you about the potential for others to drop out?
Yes, it's intimidation. And yes, I'm tremendously worried about it. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't trust the founders who put all of this in the decision of citizens, as you were saying a moment ago. Mm-hmm. He is desperate right now. He's facing 34 different counts in this trial that really opening statements begin tomorrow. 34 counts. I mean, that's like Taylor Swift's new record has 31 songs. It's a double record. He's got even more.
Culture reference there. Neil.
Absolutely. And so, you know, what's his strategy? It's to try and remove as many jurors as possible. He has to remove seven in order for a mistrial to happen because there are six alternates. He's probably not going to get there. But I think his idea is if he can get rid of a couple, particularly the ones that are the most likely to convict, that's what he's aiming for. And I think it's absolutely a violation of the gag order. The gag order is Trump is barred from making or directing others to make public statements about any prospective juror or any juror in this criminal proceeding. That's exactly what he did.
It sounds exactly like what he just did. I want to come back to the gag order because there's going to be a hearing this week, too. But, Andrew, I want to ask you because we're all trying to understand. I mean, there's 12 jurors. There's six alternates, as Neil just outlined. What happens if seven of them do remove themselves from participating as jurors in this trial? What happens then?
Well, if that happens, you have what Neil said. You have what's called a mistrial. You have to start again. But I want to just underscore a couple things. Jurors in this city, I'm in New York right now. They have rendered verdicts with respect to organized crime leaders, with respect to terrorists. I think people should not underestimate the fact that jurors are going to do their duty. It is shocking to me that we are having this conversation, Jen, right now about the former leader of the free world. But you know what? We are joining other nations that have done exactly the same thing with respect to corrupt leaders, holding them to account. There is a jury system. I think these jurors as a collective will take their responsibilities seriously. And we really, I think, should not jump to what will happen if seven drop out. I think, you know what? People have a lot of moxie. They have a lot of grit in this city. And I think that I really wouldn't be worried about it. I also think Judge Marchant is a no-nonsense judge. Mm-hmm. And as Neil knows, judges take their responsibilities, particularly with respect to the jurors, very seriously. So on Tuesday, even if there is a finding of just a fine, you can be sure that Judge Marchant is going to make it clear that any further efforts on Trump's part are going to be met with severe sanctions. I'm just confident that he is not going to put up with the kind of shenanigans that have happened already.
That's a really important point. And to be clear, not that either of you think I'm not predicting certainly that more jurors will drop out. It's just important for people to understand. And as I started the show, it's important for people to understand these people have all been through extensive questioning. I mean, very intrusive in many ways, but it's important to watch. Let me come back to the gag order here because, you know, prosecutors say Trump violated the gag order many times. Trump says the order is unconstitutional. The ball is now, as I understand, in the judge's court. As Andrew said, he's no nonsense. There's a hearing on Tuesday. What are we anticipating? What should we be watching for here?
I think what a possible argument Trump's lawyers are going to make to say he didn't violate the gag order. I think he obviously did. So they're instead going to say the gag order is unconstitutional. It's a violation of his First Amendment rights. These gag orders are imposed all the time in cases like this. And, you know, for the most important of reasons. So I think the argument's going nowhere. The prosecutors here have just asked for a $1,000 fine for each violation. Mm-hmm. But what they want is a stern warning for Trump that says, if you do this again, you're going to jail. And that's really, you know, the ball game, which is, I think, more what's the punishment going to be, not did he violate the gag order.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch that. Another event on Tuesday. Let me come back to Andrew. I mean, there's been reporting from the New York Times this morning that David Pecker is expected to be the first witness. Lisa Rubin, our colleague, predicted that and kind of outlined why that would be the case. But there's also been ongoing reporting and speculation about Trump testifying. I mean, that seems like a disaster as a non-lawyer to me. But explain to us kind of what the prosecution may be thinking in that case, if it's just Trump wanting to do it himself, what the impact could be if he decided to testify and they decided to have him do that.
Well, first, everyone should know that a defendant like Trump does not have to testify. He has no burden whatsoever, and the jury will be told that, and they cannot use the fact that he chooses not to testify in any way against him. That's true of any defendant, and so it's true for Donald Trump as well. He, though, has the right to testify, regardless of what his lawyers may strongly advise him. I am confident that lawyers like Susan Nicholas are going to throw their bodies in front of the witness stand trying to get him not to take the stand. And if you are the prosecutors, you are just licking your chops thinking, fine, you want to take the stand? Great. The amount of cross-examination material, Jen, as you know from having watched him and covered him, is, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of prior inconsistent statements. That's a polite way of saying lie.
Yeah.
Their prior bad acts. So his taking the stand would really be a death knell, I think, to the case. But he is unpredictable and has a lot of hubris. Just look at the E. Jean Carroll case, where he, by all accounts, decided after the first trial that he could do it better than his lawyers. And the judgment went from $5 million to $85 million. So if he proceeds in that sort of mode, you know, I don't think he's going to be helping himself.
Yeah, I mean, some of the reporting has suggested, probably won't surprise either of you, that prosecutors want to cross-examine him about recent lawsuits he's lost, like the E. Jean Carroll case, about attacks he's made on women, which certainly, if you're in the jury, that's a lot of context to understand. So let me ask you, Neil, tomorrow, everybody convenes at 9:30, opening statements we expect, maybe some time to hear from a witness. They are breaking at 2 o'clock because of Passover. What are you watching for tomorrow?
Well, the first thing I'm watching for is the judge's rulings on what's called the Sandoval hearing. That basically is the judge going to say, here's what I'm going to allow the prosecutors to talk to Donald Trump about, should he testify. Do they talk about Jean Carroll? Do they talk about all these other women, all these other lies, the things that Andrew was referring to? And it's for that reason, among so many others, I think there's no chance that Donald Trump is going to testify. I mean, if his legal team had an unofficial mascot, it'd be a chicken. Yeah. And like, there's no chance that I think, you know, on reality of Earth that he's going to. So that's the first thing I'm watching for. And then I'm going to watch for Pecker and how the prosecution introduces him and tells that story, because it's a remarkable story that, you know, has been chalked up to, oh, it's about Stormy Daniels stuff. No, Trump is basically capturing part of the media, the part that he's most worried about, and paying them off for their silence. That is a remarkable thing. It interfered with the 2016 election in a massive way. And that's the story we'll hear tomorrow.
It is so incredible. We had Lachlan Cartwright on last week. And his story is remarkable. I mean, he was the kind of number two guy at the National Enquirer at the time. Neil Katyal, Andrew Weissman, we will see a lot of you both on our televisions over the next several days and weeks. But thank you both for joining me. Up next, my exclusive interview with California Governor Gavin Newsom. I'll ask him about Donald Trump's trial, Joe Biden's prospects, and a jaw-dropping new ad he's rolling out focused on reproductive rights. We'll debut it right here on the show before it goes up on the air in Alabama. We'll be right back with Governor Gavin Newsom.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
This time last year, I sat down with Governor Gavin Newsom in a place you probably wouldn't expect to see the governor of California. We met up in Montgomery, Alabama, where he was sounding the alarm about the Republican rollback of reproductive rights and individual liberties in general. Of course, since then, things have only gotten worse. Recently, a near-total abortion ban from 1864 was reinstated in Arizona. And in Alabama, the site of that conversation with the governor just a year ago, hospitals were forced to pause IVF treatment. And while that IVF decision has received a lot of warranted attention, the fact that lawmakers there have even tried to make it a crime to facilitate out-of-state abortions has probably not received as much focus as it deserves. And Governor Newsom is still at it. Today, he's releasing a searing new ad that will air in Alabama as part of an effort to raise awareness about that extreme legislation. Now, in a big exclusive on this show, we're debuting that ad for the very first time. And I'll warn you, it's disturbing, but it's also important to watch.
We're almost there. You're gonna make it.
Trump Republicans want to criminalize young Alabama women who travel for reproductive care.
Miss, I'm going to need you to step out of the vehicle, take a pregnancy test.
Stop them by taking action at righttotravel.org. Campaign for Democracy Group is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Joining me now from a Planned Parenthood clinic in Sacramento is California Governor Gavin Newsom. Governor, I so appreciate you taking the time. And I just wanted to start with this ad that I've watched many times. It's incredibly chilling. It just debuted. It's going to air in Alabama. And for people who are out there who just watched that and they think, that's an exaggeration. This isn't really going to happen. What do you say to them?
Well, I'd say, look at what Idaho already did. I mean, thank God it's been enjoined by the federal courts under First and Fourth Amendment grounds. But it's a law that's in effect in Idaho. It's a law that is being advanced not just in Alabama, but Tennessee and Oklahoma as we speak. So much attention has been focused elsewhere. IVF, understandably, obviously focused tactically on what just occurred in Arizona as relates to the 1864 law. Not enough attention has been placed on the fact that we're not just criminalizing women's access to reproductive care in certain states. Now we're criminalizing their travel.
Which is so important for people to understand. People who are in states around California, like Arizona, who want to come to California, they're looking, this is a threat that people need to take seriously. I did want to talk about Arizona because for the second time in 2 weeks, Republicans in Arizona, even after they saw all of the response, blocked an effort to repeal the abortion ban based on a law, again, back in, that was passed in 1864. This time, there was video, which is pretty remarkable, of Republicans actually cheering on the floor of the legislature. I mean, what was going through your mind when you watched that video?
It sickens you. I mean, I've got two young daughters. You know, the fact that they're not going to have the same rights that their mom and dad did, the same rights their parents have. I mean, the fact that we have in this country, and it goes back to the travel point, 160,000 women that had to leave their state, 160,000 women had to leave their states last year to access reproductive care. The fact that now you have AGs like the Alabama AG that want to incarcerate up to 5 years to life those women that are aided and abetted, not just the women, but those that support the women to get out of their respective states. The fact that we now have a ban goes back to 1864 in the state of Arizona, and they're celebrating 1864. I thought the Republican Party wanted to put a wrecking ball to the 21st century. Now they want to recreate the 19th century. So for me, it's chilling and goes well beyond just the issue of women's reproductive care. It goes to access to contraceptions, voting rights, civil rights, LGBTQ rights, this consequential moment that should absorb most of our focus, not some of the other tangential things that tend to get a little more focus at this precious and important moment in American history.
Which is a really important point I think people forget. And when you and I sat down in Alabama about a year ago, you kind of warned of this, that it could be, they could be going after LGBTQ rights. That could be next. Contraception could be next. Yeah. What is next? What should people be bracing themselves for if these politics continue to run as they are?
Well, you see, they've been on a cultural purge, a banning binge. They're censoring historical facts, rewriting history. It's happened in the open. They're not just talking about rights regression in states. They're talking about the nationalization of rights being regressed. We know, you know, everybody watching knows that if Donald Trump becomes president of the United States again, he will sign a national abortion ban, period, full stop. He's the one that's responsible for the conditions that persist today. And those same conditions, again, continue to persist as it relates to rights that are being vandalized by the United States Supreme Court.
You mentioned Donald Trump, and what you said, I mean, it stuck out to me because he said he wouldn't sign an abortion ban. He leans into it should be up to the states, which is, by the way, leaving millions of women across the country without access to abortion. But it sounds like you don't believe him on his claim he won't sign an abortion ban.
No, he's a liar. He's a liar. He's not telling you the truth. He's not level setting. He'll say whatever he needs to say on any day of the week. I mean, give me a break. Look, I mean, he's created these conditions. He celebrated those conditions. He celebrated the fact that he was responsible for overturning Roe. He said that he would criminalize women. I mean, he's on tape saying these things. He'll say whatever he needs to say at a given moment. And so don't think for a second if, you know, the great Lindsey Graham sends him a bill and somehow it gets through Congress that he doesn't sign that. You know he will. And everybody, again, knows that. You can't trust this person by any stretch of the imagination. And so, look, these conditions that persist all are made possible by one person. Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, you have a lot to explain as well. And so that's why we have to, I think, again, be more clear, more concise in the condemnation and remind people of what's at stake with this election. And again, I recognize what's at stake because we're already feeling it. We're already dealing with the absorption of people seeking reproductive care in the state of California. It's up by 17% post-Dobb in this state. And I'm here at Planned Parenthood. It's important, Jen, just to remind people about a third of Planned Parenthood patients in America are here in the state of California. So no state has more responsibility, more opportunity, but bigger burden than the state of California.
I want to ask you about the Arizona Senate race because, you know, another person who's kind of attempting to change, soften, shift, chameleon, whatever you want to call it, their stance is one of Arizona's more well-known Republicans, Senate candidate Carrie Lake. I mean, she initially praised the state's abortion measure from 1864 as a great law, but now she says the state Supreme Court decision to revive it is out of step with the people of her state. She's been joking about people putting on Glocks. That's a separate but related issue. What do you make of her evolving stance on this?
Person of remarkable character and conviction with, compelling moral authority that puts her finger to the wind and moves with the prevailing winds, please. Her integrity has the form and substance, dare I say, you see the Golden Gate Bridge behind me, of fog. I don't take much of what she says at face value. I mean, she basically said last week that people, well, don't worry about any 1864 bans in Arizona. You can all go to California. You can all go to a neighboring state. We took that quite literally and quite seriously, but she can't be taken quite literally or respectively quite seriously.
More of my conversation with Governor Gavin Newsom is coming up after a quick break. I'm going to ask him about the start of Donald Trump's first criminal trial, and some of what he says might surprise you. That's next. This week was the first of many that Donald Trump will be required to sit quietly through his criminal proceedings, reportedly furious at the lack of control he has within the confines of the courtroom. So one of the two major candidates for president will be spending at least 4 days a week off the campaign trail. And yet, all indications, including from a brand new NBC News poll out this morning, are still pointing to an incredibly close race. Of course it is. With that in mind, here's more of my exclusive interview with Governor Gavin Newsom. You might have heard, Governor, in addition to the threats to women's rights out there across the country, you're sitting in a Planned Parenthood, there was a criminal trial that got underway this week in New York City. The full jury has been seated. We're expecting opening statements on Monday. There's been this kind of chorus out there that's been driving you a little crazy, just to be honest, suggesting this case only helps Trump politically. And I'm curious. I mean, you've seen the first week. You're talking to an undecided voter about why this case should matter to them. What do you tell them?
Well, I mean, it should matter. I mean, you got a president of the United States with 88 criminal counts that he's dealing with, and his first ex-president that is being submitted to this criminal case. That said, may I give you a personal point of view? This is a guy that doesn't care if he is the hero or the heel. He just wants to be the star. And in so many ways, he gets what he wants. And that's the bright spotlight and focus. Focus away from a lot of conversation we just had to focus again on him. And when we're focusing on him, I do worry electorally that he has a slight advantage. And so I'm a little concerned about the overindulgence around the day-to-day. I get it. I totally get it. The consequential nature of a criminal trial is profound and outsized in some respect, but not more outsized than democracy, more outsized than Dobbs and the consequences of him prevailing in this election in November, nor more outsized perhaps on what I thought was one of the biggest stories of the week, and that's Robert Kennedy Jr. getting on the ballot in Michigan, a consequential one of the seven key swing states. So I tend to be in that camp. A little less is more as it relates to our obsession and focus on putting any more bright lights on someone who seeks them, no matter how ill-conceived or ill-will and ill-fated his current standing might be.
So let me ask you about the electoral politics of this, as you just referenced. I mean, RFK Jr. is now going to be on the ballot in Michigan. That's a swing state. President needs to win. Anyone winning needs to win. Obviously, he just got the endorsement of a number of Kennedys this week, members of the Kennedy family. But how worried are you about the potential impact of RFK Jr. on President Biden's reelection chances?
He's a Kennedy. We revere Kennedys. At least I do. I, you know, my hero is Bobby Kennedy. There's a bust, President Biden, right behind President Bobby, President Biden of Bobby Kennedy. That's real. I mean, it's real. And I know we can look at some polls and suggest, well, here it may impact a little less. But look, at the end of the day, common sense would dictate it's real. Jill Stein is real. Cornel West is real. We know that. Those were determinative, those third party in these last elections. 44,000 votes in those three swing states. Now we've got seven potentially in play. Georgia and North Carolina, we know, are going to be perhaps a little more tough than they've been in the past, but we're making a great case. Pennsylvania, the president's a masterclass of focus on Pennsylvania. And then we go to these other states like Wisconsin. I think we have a great shot there. And then these last three, Michigan and the two that I'm referring to today, and that's Nevada and Arizona, where I'm putting all my time and energy and focus, and abortion, I think, will play an outsized role. But Bobby Kennedy Jr., if he gets on more than just that one critical swing state of Michigan and gets on the ballot in some of these others, I think you have to take that very, very seriously.
Let me ask you about, you have received a begrudging, I think it's fair to say, amount of respect from Republicans for your willingness to do things like debate Ron DeSantis, remember that guy, on Fox News, and kind of go into the belly of the beast. As we're just looking into the next critical 7 months of this campaign, what should other Democrats learn from that? How do we approach the right wing and approach the disinformation machine?
Well, you said it, the disinformation machine. So often, illusion rules. Facts don't matter. And you've got the weaponization of grievance on these anger networks, 24/7 spewing propaganda. I mean, here's one of the strongest economies in our lifetime. You have one of the most extraordinary records of any president in our lifetime on manufacturing and industrial policy, that every single day, including the last few days this week in Pennsylvania, is making profound and consequential announcements about blue collar workers and the fate and future of this country and our competitive strength. And it's not getting the attention because of the propaganda being spewed on those other networks. And so for me, we've got to meet people where they are, and we can't be in denial that they're in that space and they're getting all that noise 24/7. And what I don't want to happen is that to bleed out into other networks. So we're responding on their terms. We got to respond on our terms. And we have the issue of our time, moral issue, around issue of women and girls. They want to deny access, not just to reproductive care, but the future of women and girls, their life, their self-determination. I mean, this is profound. How can women support Donald Trump, for election this November. And I think that's the cause and case we need to make with vigor and passion and purpose, because there's profound meaning and consequences if we fall short on that and get into these sideshows that are made as events that advantage Trump and don't advantage the American people and women and girls that count on us.
Before I let you go, I do have to ask you, I know it drives you crazy that people still speculate that you're waiting in the wings to run for president. I know it's not going to happen. You know it's not going to happen. But what do you think is fueling that speculation?
I don't know. I don't think much anymore. And I'm so proud of the president and the incredible job he did. Didn't surprise me at all. And I know it didn't surprise you. I really believe that. And that's what he did at the state of the state. I think it calmed everybody's nerves. And, you know, I said to my friend the other day, I said, you know, I'm this age and we can get into debates around fitness. Look, I'd rather have 80 years behind me than those 88 federal criminal counts in front of me. And so I feel very good about Joe Biden's prospects.
My thanks to Governor Gavin Newsom. And coming up, the House passes a massive foreign aid bill. No thanks to Marjorie Taylor Greene. And later, my exclusive conversation with singer and activist John Legend. We're back after a quick break.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Here's something that I don't say a whole lot. We have some good news out of the United States Congress. Yesterday, the House passed four foreign aid bills, including aid for Ukraine, prompting cheers and chants, you can hear it there, of Ukraine in the chamber. And it happened largely because, in an apparent revelation earlier this week, House Speaker Mike Johnson finally came to see Vladimir Putin as a real threat.
You know, I can make a selfish decision and do something that that's different, but I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed.
It is the right thing. I mean, Ukraine does need funding, but this is quite a turnaround for the guy who never voted for Ukraine aid before he was speaker. He didn't vote for aid to Ukraine right after it was invaded by Russia in 2022. He didn't vote for it even after Ukrainian forces bravely repelled a Russian takeover of Kyiv. So what happened here? Well, he says he had a change of heart because of the intelligence briefings. At the same time, there are also signs that religion played a big role, including lobbying from the heads of Ukrainian churches and pressure from high-profile Baptists. I guess you could call it a form of divine intervention. But whatever really prompted Johnson to see the light, support funding for Ukraine, it was not without some bumps along the way, thanks to, of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene and others in the MAGA fringe who would apparently rather see Russia prevail. Many of them are also threatening to oust Speaker Johnson over this, all because they believe Putin's talking points rather than their own leadership. But don't take it from me. Listen to one of their Republican colleagues.
I guess their reasoning is they want Russia to win so badly that they want to oust the speaker over it. I mean, it's a strange position to take. I think I think they want to be in the minority, too. I think that's an obvious reality.
So here's the obvious reality we learned this week. The majority of the Republican conference was apparently so swayed by Kremlin propaganda that they voted no on the final passage of Ukraine funding, forcing Speaker Johnson to rely on Democratic help to get his foreign aid package across the finish line. But here's the thing. wars don't hit the pause button just because Republicans or any party, frankly, can't get their ducks in a row. Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk may have put it best when he said, better late than too late, and I hope it's not too late for Ukraine. Coming up, we'll get an inside look at an evening at John Legend's house. The artist and activist invited six people into his home to hear their personal experiences with the criminal justice system. And in our one-on-one conversation, he definitely doesn't hold back when I asked him about former President Donald Trump. We'll be right back. You may have noticed a lot of attention on our criminal justice system lately. We've been talking about it on the show. And while a certain former president throws around claims about how unfair it is to him, it's important to remember that for countless Americans without the means, the system can actually be very unfair. One of the people working to change that is John Legend. About a decade ago, he launched the Free America Initiative to push for reforms. Now the EGOT-winning artist is using a creative medium to spark change, telling their stories. Recently, he hosted six people at his home whose lives have been impacted by bail reform for a candid discussion about their experience. Here's part of that story, of their story, and our discussion about the work he's doing.
Innocent until we're proven guilty. It's not fair that we have a system that relies on you having enough money to pay your way into freedom.
I've been involved in this movement to end mass incarceration in the country for about a decade now. The work all of us did to make sure pretrial freedom was extended to more and more people, it actually paid off in improving real human beings' lives, their families' lives, and made all of our communities safer. We want to talk about what freedom feels like. We want to talk about what it means to be home with our loved ones. We want to talk about pretrial freedom, about bail reform, but personalize it.
Say good morning.
Good morning.
Pretrial freedom to me is me being able to not miss a beat on my children. Me missing time with them is very detrimental, and they really need me.
Between being able to care for my dad, being able to make sure the bills were paid, for me to be able to strategize with my lawyer. You can't do that behind bars.
The most important thing in my life right now is change. I'm just working towards getting my certifications in forklift driving, and I'm doing pretty good. I've been sober for about a year.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been affected by having relatives and friends in jail and in prison. My mother was incarcerated for a time. So many people are doing these things out of trauma, out of pain, out of desperation, out of poverty. Everybody's got a story like that. And so we have to decide whether we want to inflict more harm and more punishment on those people, or if we want to try to help them heal and grow.
Language is so important to changing minds. How we do that is by continuing to have this conversation using language of love, language of freedom, and language of liberation.
Every time I've been incarcerated, I come out much worse than I've ever been in. But if you're healed and you can help the next person heal, your community is going to be that much safer. Healed people healed people.
And everybody who's worried about safety, those investments in freedom actually are what going to make us safer. Investing in freedom, investing in human flourishing is what's going to make us more safe.
The world of true freedom is these conversations, whether it's in a very small town, a big town, whether it's a beautiful table or whether it's a card table, pulling people together and allowing them to listen to each other. That's freedom.
Joining me now is John Legend. Thank you so much for taking the time on your trip to New York to sit down with me.
My pleasure, Jen. It's great to see you and great to speak with you about this.
So first, I just wanted to start. This is pretty personal to you. I mean, all of the work you've done on criminal justice reform, really informing the public, storytelling. Tell me a little bit more about your personal connection and why you got involved in this work.
Well, growing up in Springfield, Ohio, I had many family members that interacted with the criminal justice system. Some of them were in prison, some of them were in jail. My own mother had spent time in jail. And so when we talk about pretrial freedom, when we talk about reforming the way we think about punishment in our criminal legal system,
It really does hit home.
You've been working on this for years now. You're mm-hmm. not new to this issue. Why is there such a disconnect out there about this issue?
Well, the reason why we care so much about pretrial freedom is because our jails end up housing so many people, and they're not set up to make people's lives better. And what ends up happening is people who are innocent until they're proven guilty. So in our system, everybody knows that. You watch Law and Order, you watch the life and times of Donald Trump, every trial that he's a part of, you notice he's not spending time in jail before he goes to trial. He's innocent until he's proven guilty. And we all know that. But what happens with folks who can't afford bail is they have to languish in jail until their case. I think what ends up happening is we get kind of ruled by the anecdote. You know, the New York Post will run a story, or Fox News will run a story, or the local news will run a story, and they'll say this one person got out of jail on bail and they did this crime. But the actual numbers, the actual data is resoundingly clear that folks that benefit from pretrial freedom don't go out and commit more crimes.
We just showed a clip of part of the gathering. You hosted at your own home.
We hosted at our house. We worked with a group called Zealous that kind of gathered these folks from all around the country. And we had a gathering at my house. And we wanted to really humanize the really positive effects of pretrial freedom and make sure people really understood the stories that were attached to that and the lives that were attached to that and the families that were attached to that. And so we had people come to my house and we talked about it.
One of the things that you hear from Trump supporters is that he signed the First Step Act in 2018. He's a partner in this effort. What do you say to people who say, oh no, he would be an ally. Look what he did in 2018.
He's not been an ally. I mean, I think the First Step Act was fine. It was a very kind of small reform. And to be honest, most of the reform we need is on the local and state level, because most incarceration is local and state. And most of the laws that end up being criminally enforced are local and state laws. That being said, at the same time, you know, he's claiming credit for those small things. He's also saying, you know, if people are stealing something, they should get shot in the middle of the store. When we protested the killing of George Floyd, he was advocating for the military to shoot us in the streets. He's made it clear throughout his life that he believes black people are inferior. Like, he believes that to his core, in his bones. He wouldn't let us live in his buildings back in the day. But also, when you hear some of the stray comments he makes, he clearly believes in a genetic hierarchy of humanity, and it's racially determined. So he is a tried and true, like, dyed in the wool racist. Like, in his, the core of his being, he's a racist. So I don't want to hear what he has to say about what he's done for black people. He's done very little for us. And he is at his core truly, truly a racist. And you even hear what he says about immigration and which countries he wants people to come in from. They all are very white.
That is true. That's something pretty universal about them. So I knew you were active on the campaign trail in 2020. You have a lot on your plate. Are you going to be out there campaigning for Joe Biden this
fall? Yeah, we'll get out there probably later in the year as it gets close to people making decisions about when it's time to vote. I think the choice is very clear. There's a lot been said about age and all these other things. Both of them are old. But one of them is a really decent man who's done a lot to improve lives in this country, and that's Joe Biden. That's who I'm going to be voting for, and I'll be out there supporting him.
My thanks to John Legend for a great conversation and, of course, all the work he's doing on criminal justice reform. That does it for me today. A quick reminder that my new book, Say More, is out on May 7th, and the book tour is coming to a city near you. New York City's up first on May 8th. I'll have more on who's joining me at that probably this week, and we'll be putting the full schedule back up on all of our social media pages.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.